My mantra is I can do hard things. Very simple, but I usually just take a deep breath. I mutter that to myself under my breath and I just start, because no one's ever going to criticize you for just trying. And you might learn more out of a failure that could build you up for a better success later on. So you have nothing to lose by just trying. And I feel so lucky that I'm not the fastest and I'm not the best at anything, that I was able to kind of develop that if I just went out and tried it, that's pretty darn good. And if I can accomplish it and see what happens, that it's just opened up the world to me. So I don't set myself up for a disappointment, because everything that I accomplish, there's something to be gained by it.
Sometimes when you meet people and you hear what they've achieved, it makes you reevaluate what you believe is possible. That's exactly the case with this week's guest, Amy Gubser, an extraordinary 56-year-old grandmother who this year became the first person, man or woman, ever to complete the unassisted swim from the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco to the Farallon Islands, a 30-mile stretch of cold, great white shark-infested waters off the California coast. What's more remarkable, that Amy only started her marathon swimming journey age 46. This is a fascinating conversation where Amy describes her path from these early morning swims in San Francisco's Hilly Bay through increasingly arduous challenges, including crossing the treacherous North Channel between Scotland and Ireland. Crazy. Amy shares her insights into the physical and mental preparations required for ultramarathon swimming, from nutrition strategies to managing the understandable fear of great white sharks and jellyfish swarms. Beyond her swimming achievements, Amy discusses how her work as a nurse has informed her mental toughness, the importance of breaking down age-related stereotypes, and her mission to inspire others, especially women, to pursue ambitious goals at any age. With upcoming swims planned for Scotland's deep and mysterious Loch Ness, Amy is proof that human potential really knows no bounds when matched with determination, careful preparation, and her simple mantra, I can do hard things. Amy's story is an inspiring reminder that it's never too late to pursue extraordinary achievements. Note to self. Now, over to Amy. Amy, welcome to the Impossible Network.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
It's great to finally be doing a podcast in person again after all this time. It's been too long. So here we are sitting in San Francisco. Shout out to Rob, who runs the agency, Mucho, for letting us use his boardroom. We're going to come in to have some good conversations around your unbelievable, extraordinary exploits that we're definitely going to come on and talk about in detail. But first, let's start with the first big question. Who are you as a human being?
I love that question because it's so deep and broad. I like to think that I'm a compassionate, empathic, holistic, appreciative, grateful human being. And what really gives me a lot of purpose is to help support others to achieve their goals and to push them beyond what they think is possible. Not only just as a parent, but I've done this with numerous friends and family members. I think that that's what I would love to explain that encompasses who I am.
When do you think you came to that realization about who you are as a person, as a human being? And it's a bit of encapsulation. We describe a lot of people who come to the podcast struggle with it. They tend to default to what they do and where they've come from rather than who they are in terms of a deep unpeeling of their character.
I think it's so easy to resort to defining yourself by what you do, but you have to really peel that back and look into the center. And I think the reason I'm able to kind of define that is because I come from a place of trying to like appreciate people from the inside out. And then I look at myself the same way. I don't use any material judgments, but I think that my profession has helped define some of that empathy and some of that ability to kind of sense what others need. So it kind of helps with that aspect of it. I think my family has given me patience, still frequently struggle with sometimes. And they've given me a lot of ability to kind of look at other things. But to really look at myself is really important to set as an example, because I want to look at others and have them see themselves in a deeper sense away.
Okay. Well, the second big question is, who or what made you? You mentioned your parents. But maybe sort of you could reflect on your childhood and growing up and how that your worldview developed. And obviously, we're going to come in and talk about the extraordinary feats you've achieved through your swimming. But take it back to those early days.
Yeah. Well, I come from a very humble beginning and kind of a one that was a little bit challenging to the stereotype of the time. My mom decided to divorce my dad when I was 7 years old. And this is in the early 1970s in America. That wasn't...
It's unusual.
That was unusual.
Which part of the country?
I was in the Midwest, which is even
more
deeper.
Unusual. Yeah.
And so the one thing that was the most amazing thing that I gained from that experience was that my mom prioritized herself and her happiness and knew that she would be a better parent if she chose to separate. And not only did she do that, but she moved us across the country out to California when I was 10, my sister and myself. And so our whole family relocated to Southern California because she wanted to give us an opportunity and a fresh start. Because
courageous and bold move.
Exactly.
What was her profession?
She worked for the airlines. So we did have the ability to fly back and forth to see family, which made it accessible. But, you know, I think the most important thing that really we gained out of that was my mom was kind of a bold and strong woman. So that gives me a lot of power and strength and example.
What were your feelings at the time when that happened? What was your emotional reaction to it?
Well, to the divorce, I mean, it was odd because it was still kind of in that era where, oh, your parents are divorced. And so I surrounded myself by people who didn't talk about it. And actually, there were a couple friends that I went to grade school with that found themselves in the same situation. And we kind of clustered together and were friends together. And it helped. So we had someone to talk to and knew how to support one another. Like, you know, if they forgot their lunch because there was just so much going on in the morning to get them out the door, I just shared. And we just kind of worked together like that. And it wasn't a big deal. And then when we moved out to California, I mean, we were latchkey kids and we had the beach a couple blocks away. So I just grew up on the beach. It was fabulous. So I didn't think anything negative.
Where was it?
Down in Southern California.
But where?
We lived first in Playa del Rey, and then we moved to El Segundo, and then moved to Palos Verdes when my mom got remarried. So I always had the beach within a bike distance away. It was fabulous. I was very autonomous and...
A great sense of freedom.
Great sense of freedom. Yeah, you can't grow up like that anymore. I think it was a little bit much then, but it was a little safer. So it was good. Yeah. Learned how to cook at an early age.
You say that. Sharks in the water.
Well, yeah, there is that. And there's also rip currents.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I befriended all the lifeguards, which is hilarious because they became my co-partners and co-workers later on because I came in LA County lifeguard and a few of the lifeguards remembered me hiding underneath their tower and putting all my stuff and just going boogie boarding or swimming all day. And so,
what was that show in the, was it the 80s or 90s?
Baywatch.
Yeah, it sounds very much like Baywatch.
Yeah, I can say honestly that was my childhood. So, yeah.
Amazing. I can imagine growing up in the Midwest, the worldview you would develop there would be very different from a worldview from a divorcee child of a divorced couple coming up, being brought up in California. Did you see yourself as an outsider when you were growing up here or different to the other kids, aside from the being a divorced parents' kid?
No, I didn't. I really felt California embraced a lot of diversity, and I felt freer being here in California than I would have ever been able to be in the Midwest. I mean, my mom had a group of coworkers, and some of them would babysit us. And that was when I first had the first gay couple babysit us in the 70s. I mean, one would sew me clothes and teach me how to sew and cook, and the other one would take us on bike rides and to the beach. And I mean, I feel so lucky because honestly, like, I formed no preconceived notions. They cared about us. They babysat my sister and I. And I feel so lucky that I had that as a great example, because I never had to form a stereotype later on in life.
So that early experience of being a lifeguard, at that point before going to university, and I believe you went to university in Michigan, what were those early ambitions?
Oh my gosh. Well, I was a big swimmer back then. And so lifeguarding on the ocean was
big
just...
swimmer back then.
Yeah.
So, nothing's changed.
Well, there wasn't open water swimming to the same level. So that's just a whole nother realm that's developed since. But I was a ranked age group swimmer, and I did get a scholarship to University of Michigan. But being a junior lifeguard my whole childhood, the natural evolution was to be an ocean lifeguard. And back when I passed the county lifeguard test, it wasn't like stratified for diversity or affirmative action in any way, shape, or form. And there were very few female lifeguards. And it was on the beginning.
Oh, really? That's surprising.
Yeah. No. You had to be X number, like they would give you a popsicle stick when you finished. And if you had a number on it, you qualified to be trained as an ocean lifeguard. And so it was an honor and a privilege.
Was that, you think, because of sort of a misconception or preconceived ideas about the difference in terms of physicality and sexes and ability to swim and survive in a strong ocean current?
Yeah. And they purposely did the test in the early spring where there would be ginormous surf, cold water. And I think it suited the men a little bit better. But I feel grateful because that wasn't something that offset my abilities. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I kind of thrived in that. So I was able to help kind of destroy the stereotypes and myths that were preconceived of that kind of old, good old boys network of the lifeguards. And I had a lot of respect as an ocean lifeguard. I mean, that's where Greg and I met. And we actually met in junior lifeguards way back when, and then lifeguarded next to one another as we got stationed in Hermosa Beach next to each other in the towers. And here we are. But, you know, it was really a good time to kind of be involved in that program. So I feel really fortunate.
Any defining sort of mentors or teachers that were instrumental in those early formative years?
Yeah, the women, we kind of gathered together and banded kind of a good network to help support one another, because, you know, sometimes we weren't felt welcome. But I had Shannon Carr-Davy, who was one of my instructors, who was my boss. She was a permanent lifeguard. And I had Cindy Cleveland, who actually has her, she was one of the premier and early ocean water ultra marathon swimmers. And she was also one of my bosses. And so I feel so well and supported around kind of just evolving as a good water person and like understanding the water. They always made sure that we were supported and like really trained so that we were capable. So it was really a pretty incredible time.
Mm. Any other sort of defining experiences or moments that you think were instrumental in setting you on the path that you've been on?
You know, I'm pretty mindful. So even a small experience that I have, I kind of pocket it back into my deep pockets of my brain and my being, and I can pull meaning out of it. I would say, honestly, having the profession that I have, being a nurse, probably refined my craft of being able to compartmentalize portions of what I need to approach so I don't get overwhelmed. Because, you know, I might be taking care of a patient that we are fighting so hard to save their life. And that's so intense. Yet I leave that room once they're stabilized and I go to my next patient. And guess what? They're making the transition on the way out. And I've got to be there mentally, emotionally, and physically to help that family adjust to that. And then I might get assigned another patient that's being admitted to the hospital with a completely unexpected tragedy. And I have to be there to greet that family emotionally, mentally, and physically, as well as take care of that patient that might be unstable. And so to be able to do all of that within my shift time and be able to kind of ground it, move to the next one without carrying over or being callous, is really a craft. And that, I think, having all the years behind me as a professional nurse has really allowed me and to kind of cultivate that skill. Mm-hmm. I think that's single-handedly the best prep for this, because when I was a swimmer in college, I left that pool with a lot of unfinished business. And I had a coach, never accomplished what I was projected to swim and accomplish, and I didn't meet the goals that I had set for myself. And that was extremely frustrating. And I had a coach who was had a master's degree in exercise physiology and could see that I was a very unique athlete and tried to train me to push me in an athletic sense. But what he missed was the ability to support me mentally and emotionally. And it was during that late 80s, early 90s where you got to just tough it out. Mm. Like, you know, you were weak if you needed support, or you were weak if you couldn't handle the pressure of the training or the competition. And I think that I would have been much better supported knowing what we know now. Mm. But my coach to this day loves that I got back into swimming, and he just laughs. He said, "See, I told you. There you are."
Easy to say now.
Easy to say now.
So you, when you went to Mission University, was that for nursing or was it for some medical related course?
I went there with kind of an open slate. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Yet if you look at all my pictures when I was a young child, I was always a nurse for Halloween, and my aunt was a nurse and I always emulated her. So I should have known this. And ironically, the only degree I couldn't get at University of Michigan was nursing, because they do clinic hours in the hospital, and we traveled during the time that we would have clinic hours, and we couldn't make those up. So I was told that's the only degree that's really difficult to achieve with our travel schedule. So they recommended I didn't study nurse. So I ended up getting my degree in exercise physiology and went right into nursing school after that. Hmm. So, I mean, it was a good bridge. Feel grateful.
Just a question, and the way you just describe yourself as human being, you've got, I can sense your description of the experience you have when you're swimming and the mental approach to it, as I was a track and field athlete. And although you swim in teams, and when you swim in teams and you're in swim meets, it's an individual pursuit.
Yeah.
And it takes a certain mental fortitude, regardless of the event, to the discipline to keep the training up day after day after day, month after month after month.
Yeah.
And you're very inner focused, and there's an inner dialogue about what you're doing physically and the mental focus to, one, believe what doesn't seem possible is possible with training and discipline and dedication. But at the same time, you have to put in the hours, and it's a very sort of singular individual pursuit where the thought of others doesn't really occur to you, because you're not on a football team, you're not on a hockey team, you're not on a rugby team, where you have to think about the guy or the girl or the person next to you. Nursing, however,
completely different sort of mindset. And the way you describe that seems quite alien from the sort of the discipline of swimming. Where do they meet for you? Where is there a crossover? Where does that, those two, because it almost feels like there's two sides to you.
Yeah, I definitely think it expands my wheelhouse and definitely pushes. I think where they intersect is, when you're training as an individual athlete, if you really think about it, like when you're swimming in the pool and you're swimming pool events, you're training thousands of hours for a minute swim. Like, it's unbelievable the amount of investment that you do. At least with the open water and for these longer ultra marathons, you're training a lot of hours to swim a lot of hours. So it kind of almost makes a little bit better investment in that sense. But being a nurse has taught me a little bit more about my depth and strength and ability to kind of keep myself calm under the most stressful situations. And that is that tie over. Because a lot of times when you're doing these big events, you know it's going to be big. You know it's going to be a little bit painful, but you have to learn how to not mind that it is going to be. And you also have to learn the duration may not be definable, or you might not be able to see that light yet at the end of the tunnel. And I think nursing has pushed me to kind of know that sometimes you don't get out of that gray zone for a long time because you have a very unstable patient and you might be at that bedside and you might have to take a moment to go to the bathroom and you cannot go. And you have to figure out how to, like, mentally figure out how to strategize to be able to ask for help to go take care of yourself and your needs. But it's not on your own time. And I think these ultra marathons, a lot of it's not on your own time. It's a lot longer than you really can appreciate before you start. And there's so many variables that come into play that can influence how the swim goes. And you have to be able to pivot. So I think that's where nursing also brings the intersect, is you have to be able to pivot on a second. Like, you have to change your focus and your goal minute to minute sometimes. And that's also what happens in these big swims.
I started this podcast initially interviewing people before it even became a podcast. It was just I was making videos in New York because I was meeting some really what I called extraordinary people doing extraordinary things. And they were all doing things like marathon, rowing across great expanses of water, people with Parkinson's running, cycling, and climbing their way across America, youngest kid to climb up Everest, and just doing extraordinary things, but all for some form of social good. So I had this idea to create this thing called the Impossible Network, ordinary people doing extraordinary things for social good. It sort of evolved once I started the podcast into something that was very different. It was just, I wanted to explore people's journey. And again, recently it's evolved into honing in on these three questions I ask is, who are you as a human being? What or who made you you? And then what are you working to achieve before you shuffle off this mortal coil? You have done something that's akin to why I started, by being an ordinary person, but done some extraordinary things. And you have a very strong sense of social good in terms of what you do as a nurse. But what you did and how you came onto my radar was through, again, and serendipity played a great part in this podcast as well, because I like to explore the impact of serendipity. It was through sitting in a restaurant with my colleague Sam here in Larkspur. And someone you work with happened to be sitting next to us. And we got talking about you. And she went, oh, I work with Amy. Wow, what a chance. So this is completely sort of screwing up with my mind, because it's a bit of the old Impossible Network, the new, the serendipity, it's all mixed in together. So I want to talk about this extraordinary thing that brought you onto my radar, which was this epic swim that had never been done before from San Francisco Bay, I suppose you'd say.
Golden Gate Bridge.
Mm-hmm. To the Farallon Islands, which most people have never heard of, but are about 29, 30 miles off the coast of California.
It's a lot off the radar of a lot of people, yeah.
But probably the most intense and breeding grounds of great white sharks on the planet.
Yeah.
And you swam there without a cage.
Yeah. And wetsuit.
And did
no wetsuit.
And no wetsuit. I mean, that is just mentally for me, I go, oh my goodness, I just can't even conceive of the mental fortitude and the strength of will and the courage to take on such a challenge and achieve it. The only person ever. Not woman, man, woman, no one has ever done it.
Any human, yeah.
Any human being to have done it. It is utterly extraordinary. So when I ask that question, what are you working to achieve? You go, you know what? Work's done. You could quite happily say, yeah, I've done everything I need to do. Tick that box. But I'd love you to talk about that journey to that moment and having left Michigan, ambitions unrealized, as you said, to have rediscovered swimming, but not in a way that most people rediscover sport after many years and get into senior sort of competition. To have taken on marathon swimming of that scale is quite extraordinary. So maybe you could just talk about that journey back into it and what led you to suddenly going, I am going to take on this challenge that no one else has ever done and believe that it's possible. Because one of the things as well, it's funny, I got cycling a lot around here and I pass this sign every time I cycle around China Camp in San Rafael. And it's, I don't know if it's a church, but it's near the city, the civic center. And it says, anything is possible when you believe, which I genuinely, given this impossible network of people I interview have done extraordinary things, obviously you have to believe. So talk about what led you to that point and that journey. That's my convoluted sort of question.
Yeah, no, it's actually, I have a very specific starting point. So I was out of the water, raising family, profession, married, you know, just living life. And February, 10 years ago, so this was 2014, a friend of mine, we had gone out to dinner, and he's a very close friend. He swims in San Francisco Bay, and he kind of egged me on and challenged me. He said, hey, why don't you join me for a swim tomorrow? Of course, it's February, so it's really cold. Without a wetsuit, San Francisco Bay. I came up with, I can't tell you the countless number of excuses to not join him. And he just kept calling me out. He's like, you're so full of shit. You're so, like, come on, you can do this. And I didn't think it was humanly possible that I could. So I agreed to meet him 7 o'clock in the morning, the next morning on the Saturday. And we met at the South End Rowing Club down in San Francisco. So he met me at the door. Before I even gone to meet him, I had rummaged through my collection. My husband had a thermal, you know, cap that I could wear on my head. We were looking for my gloves and booties to wear because I couldn't wear a wetsuit. So I was trying to figure out all these other things. But I just know that I can't swim with that stuff. So I took the thermal cap. I had my swimsuit. I dusted off my goggles from 24 years ago. I mean, I couldn't see in them because they were so old, but I was able to use them. And I met him there. We got ready to swim. We put our stuff in the lockers, walked out to the beach, and my toes touched that icy water. It was 52 degrees. And it overwhelmed me. Like, I started getting tears in my eyes. And watching him, he literally just left the beach and left me standing there with tears in my eyes.
He had no wetsuit on.
No wetsuit on. He just marched right in the water and away he swam. And I was paralyzed. I was stuck at that moment. And I didn't know what to do because I couldn't
just
figure out.
Just your feet
out. Just my feet in the water. And I knew I had to get my body in the water.
Was it sunny?
Yes, it was sunny. But the warmth from the air, it was a crisp morning, so it wasn't warm. It was, there was no clouds in the sky, but it was chilly. So not see your breath chilly, but chilly enough, because 7 a.m. is still pretty early. So I was paralyzed. Tears are welling up in my eyes, and I started walking a little bit further, And his friend noticed that I was having a hard time and just actually stood there and stayed with me. And we just kind of creeped in the water a little bit deeper, a little bit deeper. And then I kind of pushed off and I lost my breath immediately, because if you've ever gotten in cold water, you cannot breathe. It takes your breath away. And I hadn't had a chance to really acclimate because I've never done this before and I didn't know what to do. So now I'm crying and I can't breathe, so I'm starting to panic. And it overwhelmed me and I just was trying to figure out what to do. And my friends...
Standing room? Or you in depth?
I was kind of just treading water, like dog paddling. Yeah. And my friend's friend looked at me. I don't even know his name to this day, but I can picture him so clearly in my eyes. He looked me right in the eye and he said, put your face in the water and start to swim. And I was so shocked, but I needed that clear direction. So I did. I put my face in the water and I started to swim. Well, even though I hadn't been in the water for 24 years, I'm still a pretty decent swimmer. And I've, you know, fooled around a little bit and I know I'm a decent swimmer. I ended up catching up to my friend Robert, who had no idea I had this panic attack and had no idea that I needed any assistance. And he looks at me calmly. He says, oh, there you are. And I didn't tell him that I had this horrible experience on the beach, but he said, are you doing okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. And so we swam a little bit further. And all of a sudden, my body started getting warm and every cell in my body became alive. Mm-hmm. And it was an adrenaline endorphin rush that I'd not experienced before. And so we finished our swim and I went home and Greg is just waiting to hear how this went, because he was like so surprised I agreed to go. And I walk in and he's smiling and I said, I loved it. And he couldn't believe it. And I said, could I bribe you with getting a Ghirardelli's chocolate sundae if you watch me swim tomorrow? Because I knew Robert wasn't going to be there and I don't know anybody that
and
swims.
And you wanted to do it again?
And I wanted to do it again. I went the very next day.
How long did it take you to acclimatize once you had that shock, once you got your head in the water?
Yeah, it took me 15 minutes.
To acclimatize?
It just takes a little while for you to warm up your body. So as you start swimming, the first few minutes, you can still feel the icy feeling on your body. And then as you get moving, your body starts to warm up because you're using your muscles. So about 15 minutes. And then all of a sudden that rush.
And then how far did you swim that day?
Just 25, 30 minutes, like not too long. And each day I would go out, I'd go about the same distance, and I didn't know anybody, but I joined
and
the
every
South
day
End.
The same experience.
Yeah, same experience.
15 minutes of abject pain.
Yeah, yeah. And then it became less and less until all of a sudden that endorphin rush happened and your body warmed up. So I knew I was doing that. There's someone that at my club says it's 100 strokes to fabulous. So, you know, it takes a little while. So you can get it down to that short of period. And, you know, I just started meeting people and then I realized I was actually kind of good at swimming. And I started building my community and then I started getting invited to do swims with people. And my first big swim was Gibraltar. So I swam from Spain to Africa, did the Gibraltar Strait.
How far is that?
It's 8.5 miles.
Oh, only that.
Yeah, it's not a very wide distance, but it's the largest shipping port and channel. Like, I mean, we were constantly dodging tanker ships and our captain was in, you know, communication with all the ships coming and going. And we're also he's there on the phone with the Moroccan Coast Guard. And so, yeah, it was a really fabulous experience. It was a beautiful swim and it went really well.
So why did you pick that one as your first solo?
I didn't. I just got invited and I'm like, yes, I'm going. And so we made it happen. And it wasn't too long of a distance. I thought it was definitely something
What did Greg choose. Think?
Oh, Greg loved it. He was so excited to...
Did he not worry?
I think not. I mean, the thing that's history behind the context is Greg's dad was one of the first Ironman triathletes. And Greg also used to paddle for the original swimmers that like were cutting like and forging the course of this ultramarathon swimming back in the early 80s. So he has context around it.
Okay.
So he wasn't too worried about me. He was more excited and encouraged that I liked it, but a little bit cautious because some of the swims are big. Yeah.
So at that point, when you were just going out every day here in San Francisco Bay, down by Fisherman's Wharf,
yep,
and just swimming out and training.
Yep.
Once you'd done that Gibraltar swim, what was the next? Did you then set yourself some a new goal around what you wanted to achieve rather than, because a lot of people would just do it. And I know people that do so cold water or long distance swimming, but they just do it to keep fit and they just love it. Obviously for the same reason that you loved it, the endorphin release impact, but not to actually take on audacious records or goals that have never been achieved before by any human.
Yeah. I think I was more inspired by the people that I was building with my community of swimmers, because they all had goals. So, and they all were doing really interesting swims. So it was really kind of inspiring for me. The next goal that I set was Lake Tahoe. It's here, it's local, it's, you know, it seemed like a very manageable distance. It was more of the typical standard crossing lengths, because it's similar to the English Channel, like in distance. And most people use
those
the English
Channel. Most people don't
Channel.
Know the English Channel, 22 miles?
Yeah, it's 22 miles, correct. But, you know, with the English Channel, you go with the current. So most people swim for more than that, but you only get credit for 22. So that's kind of the traditional length of a typical channel crossing. So I thought, well, let me see how that goes. Oh, I learned a lot on that one. That one was a really tough one.
Freshwater.
It's freshwater and it's at altitude. So two things I kind of didn't really appreciate to the same capabilities that I have now. So it was a really good learning experience. I finished the swim and it was very hard. But after that, I knew I was capable of doing things. And I just learned more of what worked better for me to train and what was easier for me to look at as far as things I was good at. So I started strategizing at that point for bigger swims. And the one that I really wanted to do and was very exciting for me would be the North Channel between Ireland and Scotland, because that was 22 miles.
That's the Irish Sea.
That's the Irish Sea, yeah.
Between Dublin and?
It's from Donaghadee, which is on the coast,
yeah,
outside of Belfast, actually, in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And then across to the Scottish shores. You try to aim for Port Patrick.
Near Stranraer.
Correct. But you can, anywhere along that coastline. It's a very unfriendly coastline.
Oh, my goodness. This is just freaking me out. I've been on a ferry
a
number of times, a ferry from Stranraer to there, to Belfast. I know how rough that water is.
Yeah.
Even in summertime.
Yeah.
And you swam it.
Yeah, I swam that. And that one was like speaks to me. Like most people ask me, why don't you do the English Channel? And I kind of don't want to, because I feel that it's overdone. And
you set yourself the challenge, not the English Channel, but to do the Northern Channel.
Yeah, because at the time that I started looking at it, less than 40 people had accomplished that swim. Mm-hmm. And it took me 2 more years to be brave enough to sign up to do it. And when I accomplished it, that was the biggest success. I was so proud. And I was the 18th woman to finish that swim and the 63rd person to accomplish that swim. And more people have hiked Everest. More people have hiked all the peaks. And that was considered to be the hardest channel swim of the Ocean 7, which is a list that was comprised by Steve Molitonis. It's an honorable list of swims.
What is it then? So the English Channel, the Northern Channel.
Correct.
Gibraltar.
Cook Straits.
Oh, in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Saguaro in Japan. Mm-hmm. And then Catalina and Molokai.
Where's that?
Catalina's down south in Southern California. That's also 22 miles. And Molokai is a little bit longer. So Molokai to Oahu.
Oh, in Hawaii.
Yeah. That one's a little bit longer. I want to say that's 24 miles, 25 miles.
Have you done all 7?
No. I have several friends that have accomplished that Ocean 7 list, But I'd have to do the English channel and it's just not on my radar. So that list is not necessarily my list. I like other weird things.
Yeah. Okay. So before we get into talking about the shark infested, jellyfish infested Farallon swim, what other ones have you taken on, accomplished?
So here locally, I've done round trip Angel Island, which is considered to be a tactically difficult challenge because you've got cross currents and you have to cross the shipping lanes four times. So that one's a really hard one to execute. Did that one. I did Monterey Bay.
From where?
You leave the beach right at, you know, Aquatic Park, Fisherman's Wharf area, and then you go out around Angel Island and back to the same beach. So that's really hard to nail.
Angel Island, the one that's south of Tiburon.
Correct.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's a large island, so you got to go out around the whole thing and come back. So it's a pretty good one.
Just as an aside on that, I mean, anyone that comes to San Francisco, naturally, the one of the sights to see is Alcatraz and the famous story that no one ever escaped Alcatraz. But
exactly.
They say that someone might have escaped and they had to swim. They said a chance of the swimming from Alcatraz. And going, you could do that in your sleep.
Well, yesterday I swam to and from Alcatraz with a friend of mine that flew in from Singapore. And we had a great swim. So it's very manageable.
Exactly.
But I go all over the world and I tell people I've done these swims and they're like, but have you done Alcatraz? Everywhere. Everyone always asks. So it's our joke in the open water swim community. Well, it is our warm up, but we don't underappreciate the currents because they're very strong. It's not to be underappreciated, but it's just hilarious because the distance at Alcatraz is 1.2 miles.
It's not all.
Yeah. From the rock to the beach. Yeah. So it's not very far. But most people have this folklore that has been built up and generated from media and from just kind of the hype of it that it's the most unmanageable water. So, yeah. So that's why it's funny. Like, you've been to the Northern Irish Sea and you've seen how rough it is.
Oh, yeah.
And I could tell people, yeah, I just swam that. And they'll be like, oh, but have you swam Alcatraz? Yeah. We just laugh. It's kind of funny.
Well, the other one as well, that I've got a friend that swam it. Shout out to Simon Hill, who used to work with me at McCann. He swam Manhattan Island.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Which is another one to sort of tick off the list. And I believe you did that.
I did that, yeah.
But in slightly different circumstances. So I think he had experienced I believe you were quite ill.
I was. Our swim was at night, which I was really excited about. It was the first night swims they executed. But I had the luxury of swimming the day after a rainstorm. And you know what the adage is. You don't want to be anywhere near that water after a rainstorm. So I just knew I could not swallow the water. So I dive in, and the first wave that hit me, I swallowed. And I'm like, oh, geez.
Oh.
And an hour and a half later, I was throwing up. And I was swimming with a friend of mine who I train with. And typically we swim perfectly in unison. And she was wondering where I was and she looked back and she's watching me hurl actively, vomiting. And she just shook her head. She goes, okay, it's going to be a long one. But the way they strategize that swim, that a Doritos bag can make it around the island, you know, with challenging the currents that direction, like we really didn't have a lot of obstacles. We just had to swim fast enough to make the current. And we were swimming at the exact speed that we needed to, despite me being ill. And the only thing that I used to feed on because I was so ill was Coca-Cola. Like literally just drank Coca-Cola for 8 hours and I made it. So there's a testimony there, but you know.
Well, that's incredible.
I was really happy to do the swim at night.
Interest. Where'd you leave from in Manhattan?
We left the tip of it. There's a marina that we pulled out of kind of in the financial district area. And then we jumped off of, I want to say Pier 41. No. I don't remember the name of the pier.
So you went north. You didn't go south, round and up the East River. You went up the Hudson.
No, we came back down around the Hudson.
Yeah, because it would make sense that the current.
So we went around the tip. Exactly.
Yeah, so you went around Battery Park.
Exactly. Battery Park. So right before where the ferries leave from. Yeah. We jumped at the pier right there.
Yeah, I know where you are.
Yeah, so because we had to hold up for one of the ferries.
Yeah.
Then we zipped around that island, went up the East River,
You just kind of zipped around.
Yeah, we kind of zipped around and then went under, I think, isn't that the George Washington? Or no, the George Washington was the last
one. No, because you go up, you go under the Brooklyn Bridge and then
that's
you go to
right.
Manhattan and then under Williamsburg and then under the Queens.
Yeah, the event is called 20 Bridges. And I don't obviously know which bridge I did when, but, you know, it was absolutely fabulous. I think the weirdest water was the Harlem. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it was a channel. It was, like, really not very wide. And, yeah. I'm glad I didn't see what I... Yeah, a lot of industry.
Oh, well.
Well, I survived. I mean, I'm here.
It sort of led me on to the next question, which was, I mean, when you're taking on any physical challenge, whether it be running or Ironman or cycling, nutrition and diet play a massive part in it. Coca-Cola, fine, okay, on one occasion. But how do you prepare for this? And how do you, in the preparation and the training that you have to do, how do you balance your diet? And how do you sort of ensure that you've got enough intake before? And then how do you, when you're taking on a challenge that might be in excess of 10, 11 hours, how do you keep hydrated and what do you eat?
Yeah, that is the question of the century. I think if one individual could nail it and it applied to everybody equally and it supported them, they would be a millionaire, like hands down. There are so many different products out there. If you ever walk into any of those fitness stores that have nutrition, there is a shelf and a huge area of product. Because the bottom line is as an athlete, and especially as an endurance athlete, you have to know what your innate metabolism is. Mm-hmm. What works for me will not necessarily work for my husband, Greg, or for you, Sam. Like, it's your body is just built differently and has a different pace. So you have to be able to balance the hydration, the nutrition, the carbohydrate, and the prolonging of that so that you have enough energy for the event without building up lactic acid, or at least being able to mitigate the lactic acid so it's not going to stop you. So it takes, during those big long training swims, that's where you practice your nutrition and you just hope that it works. And I've been on swims where I thought I had my nutrition nailed, and you get on the swim, like the one in Brown Manhattan, and I threw up the whole way. Like, I had not expected that. So you always have to have a backup plan. And so the bottom line is, the product that necessarily works for me might not work for the other individual, but the whole goal is to have trialed it enough to know that it should work. And then the second best asset is your crew. Because if something happens and you're not tolerating it, they need to know what to do to get you out of it. So I've been on many swims. I love crewing. I learn more about swimming, more about nutrition by crewing for others. And I've adapted a few items and into my repertoire. But being able to save somebody and recoup them and get them through that phase, that's where you learn the most.
I mean, what do you take on when you're in the water? Because you're not getting out of the water into the boat. You're actually sort of treading water and having to drink and consume some form of to replenish your calories.
Exactly. They throw you a bottle attached to a string of your nutrition. So on the Farallon swim, I used this product called CarboPro, which is no longer make it. So I have this coveted supply that I'm judiciously like portioning out for my next year or so till I discover the next product that'll work for me, mixed with chicken bone broth. So I had protein and it wasn't, so I could have that cold or hot. I prefer not to heat my feeds up until it's necessary. And so then it just tasted like hot soup when I had it warmed, which was great. Then I also just drink regular water in between. I did make mashed potatoes. And they were a little bit looser, like I made them with a little bit more butter and loosened it up. Like, they were the instant ones so that they're thinner in nature. And then I also had peaches with the syrup, which cut the taste of the salt while I swam. So that was a brilliant, I loved that one. That was like a delicious treat. Sometimes I'll have some chocolate of some sort and, you know, have that on the swim. What I didn't expect was how cold the water got. So when they started heating my feeds, that was brilliant. But what they also did was, a friend of mine always brings hot chocolate, and she started giving that to me during my nutrition breaks. And that was brilliant. I loved that. And the other thing they sent out is they put two hot bottles. One was just of water that I could either drink if I wanted to, but I poured it on my hands and on the back of my neck. Mm-hmm. So it kind of just warmed me for a moment. Mm-hmm. And that was brilliant. So that was what I fed on for the Farallons. Oh, and I had one granola bar. I was hungry and I wanted to chew something, because most of the time you don't have time to chew. Mm-hmm. You just got to keep going.
I mean, every swim is different, but is there some sort of signal inside you that you go, right, I need my nutrition now? Is there a trigger to that? Is it just fatigue, or do you start to feel the buildup of lactic acid?
You know, you try to stay ahead of that, because if you feel that, it's already too late.
Yeah.
So kind of the typical feeding plan is just on a time cycle. So I usually swim the first hour and then every 30 minutes after that. Now, I might only take between 2 to 4 ounces of something, so it's not a lot. Mm-hmm. So I could kind of just give myself just enough for my body to be able to metabolize, but not too much that it has to like slosh around in my stomach. But staying ahead of that lactic acid, because at around hour 8, that's typically when most people switch from aerobic capacity and they start to their anaerobic. Yeah. And they usually get really grumpy. It's just a natural thing that happens. And you're also building the lactic acid, so you might be more sore. So balancing when you could use medications like Tylenol or Advil, Naprosyn, you know, something for an anti-inflammatory, those are really key to get through that. Also, caffeine can really help when somebody's grumpy. That one's a magic little one.
I mean, the Farallon was, what, 17 hours?
Yeah, 17, just over 17 hours.
I mean,
yeah.
That is a long time being in the water. I mean, is that the longest swim in terms of duration?
No, Monterey Bay and Santa Monica Bay were about the same distance and about the same time. So I feel like I knew that I could do that for that length of time. I have friends that have swam for longer than 24 hours, and they call it the 24-hour club. I don't think that I'm there. Like, that's their wheelhouse, but I think I'm just shy of that. Like, I don't really think that I would want to push past that. And I've known one of my favorite people on this earth is Sarah Thomas. She swam 4 back-to-back English channels, and it was like 84 hours. It was ridiculous, like unbelievable, superhuman.
What was in Diana Nyad, was it?
Diana Nyad, yes.
What was the length of her swim?
Hers was, I think, 80 miles or 80, between 80 and 100 miles. It's a long distance. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hers was definitely, I think, 40 some odd hours, something like that. Yeah. And I just don't know how people can do that. Like, that's superhuman, honestly.
Well, it's all relative, isn't it?
So,
so let's talk about that experience. You knew. What was it that made you go, right, I'm going to do this. I believe I can do it. I believe it's possible.
Well, it's kind of an obsession. We live very close to the beach and we are always watching water and always looking at the water. And when you see those islands peek out on the horizon, because it's not every day that they show themselves, but when you see them, they're kind of creepy and odd. And I read the book Devil's Teeth, and I kind of became obsessively kind of inspired by those islands. I thought they were kind of creepy. And I would joke with my husband. I'm like, you know, I could swim there. And he would laugh. Ha, ha, ha. That's funny. Yeah, I bet you could. I know you could. And as that joking started turning into a strategy that my husband was really hoping to talk me out of, it was a few years in the making that it started, that I could strategize to plan for this. But before I could even do that, I had to swim the North Channel, Monterey Bay, Santa Monica Bay. So I knew that I had the cold and the distance. So I had to build up to it. So once I finished all those swims and I was joking about it, he knew I was serious.
Were you telling your colleagues that you train with as well about this ambition?
Some knew.
Did they think you were nuts?
Oh, absolutely. But we're the type of nuts that you say, well, let's do this. And they're like, that's absolutely crazy. And so what time are we showing up? You know? So I don't know if they're the most realistic influencers because they'll encourage my crazy. And my husband was really trying to talk me out of it because it's scary.
Your kids must have also been a bit like...
They were a little freaked out too. Yeah, I'm not going to lie. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's why it went viral that I'm the grandmother that swam it. Because I have a lot in my family that would be like suffering a big loss if that didn't go well. So I had a lot at stake to accomplish this swim.
So for people that don't know, why is it? I mean, I think people think about great white sharks in terms of South Africa, Australia. Don't really associate San Francisco as being the major breeding ground of great whites. I mean, what level are we talking here of great whites in terms of the risk level?
Well, they refer to the red triangle in the San Francisco Bay Area. So the Farallones to Bodega Bay, down to Santa Cruz area. And statistically, that's the highest number of sharks that they've seen. I mean, they filmed Shark Week out at the Farallones, so they know.
Let's not forget that there was a film called Jaws made.
Oh, that too. But I think that was actually on the East Coast, which actually has a resurgence of like a significant great white population. I think just in general, humans do not want to be prey. Mm-hmm. We like to be the hunter. We don't like to be hunted. So I think like bears and cougars and great whites are terrifying to most humans because it's something that's hunting us.
How did you confront that? Because it must have been a thought at the forefront of your mind. I mean, leaving aside jellyfish that are going to sting you, you're not wearing a wetsuit, you're not in a cage. And was it daytime or nighttime?
I started at 3 a.m, so it was dark.
Dark, yeah.
Yeah. You know, you can't accomplish the swim if it's in the front of your brain. You have to put it back in the back. And I had to just know that I had, what are the statistics of swimmers in this area being hit by a shark? Very low. I mean, it has happened and it's been documented, but
haven't gone swimming. Breeding ground.
That's true. I did talk to the shark specialists in the area.
What did they say?
They gave me a time window where there was less sharks at the island. Now there's resident sharks at the island, but the migratory pattern of the sharks, typically between March through the end of July, beginning of August time, there are less sharks. Mm-hmm. So that was my window I had to work with. And I had to kind of weigh, do I want less sharks, colder water, or warmer water and possibility of more sharks? And I opted for the colder water and less sharks. So I was trying to be reasonable about understanding and appreciating the wildlife. Yeah, so I'm not going to lie.
Did you see any?
I couldn't see anything. Now, I will tell you that I think that was the best for me to have like a sensory deprivation. I had a bubble of fog around me, which actually prevented too much wind, which was great. But literally 100 meters in any which direction was the only visibility we had. And I was on a big fishing trawler, so everybody on radar can see him and he could see everybody on radar. So we were safe, but we couldn't see anything. And there was red tide in the water, so I couldn't see anything past my fingertips. Now, I have been on a round-trip relay.
What's red tide?
Red tide is an algae in the water, and it makes the water kind of a murky brown, so the visibility is completely skewed. But I have been on a relay to and from the Farallones before, and I just remember I could see into infinity, like in this crystal blue water. And I was kind of expecting that, but what I got was nothing. And I think that was actually better because then I didn't have to have an imagination of what was that shadow or was that, you know, I didn't have to go there.
And what about jellyfish?
Jellyfish, they're a bugger. They're the nastiest, most realistic obstacle to most of these big swims are the jellyfish. My Monterey Bay, I got stung probably 1,000 times, and I swam through miles and miles of thick jellies where I couldn't even, it was like swimming in jello. It was that bad and that thick.
And they're stinging you constantly.
Oh yeah, head to toe.
Do you become sort of anesthetized to it, or do they continue?
I took allergy medicine to kind of quell it, and I was really swollen after the swim. I didn't have any respiratory issues, but the only thing I kept thinking to myself was, this is absolutely horrible, but I'm not going to do this again, so I better just finish it. So I did. And when I was swimming on the Farallons, there was waves of where there were jellies, but it was certainly not to that same level.
But they still stung you.
Oh, yeah. I had to peel them off my face because you couldn't see them coming at you. And there were that brown water, and there are brown colored jellyfish. You don't see them. And so I just would peel it and throw it off my face. Yeah. And so my arms got stung, and you know, they wrap around you a little bit. You know, kind of sucked.
Wow. And the stinging doesn't put you into like a the anaphylactic shock or anything like that?
I am very lucky that I don't react to them to that level, but I have several friends that are very reactive to jellyfish. So we have a strategy with medicines. So the red tide is an algae, which I was reacting to a little bit, but I used allergy medicine balanced with another H2 blocker that people take that helped potentiate, and it helped balance me. So I was fine.
What do you think you've learned about yourself over these mammoth marathon swims that you've done?
That I'm a pretty tough cookie.
It's been 10 years you've been doing this.
Yeah. I know that's not very long, really, in the overall scheme of things.
Have your family observed a difference in you?
I would say, yeah. I mean, I think they knew that I'm a pretty strong and reliable and solid person, but now it's just at amp 10. Or maybe 11.
And so what about you said you're a grandmother. I mean, how do you think, I mean, you talked at going back to the beginning in terms of who you are as a human being. I mean, it's not many grandchildren look at their grandmother and can say, yeah, my grandmother swam across the Irish Sea from Scotland to Ireland or through shark infested waters. I mean, it's a pretty heroic, a superhuman sort of task. What impact do you think that is going to have on their life experience? What influence or impact do you think it's going to have on them? Or would you like to hope it's going to have on them?
Well, really what I hope is that they're proud of it, that they know that anything is possible, especially if you work hard toward it, and that don't let age or anything stop you from accomplishing your goals. And just to say that they got a badass grandma is pretty darn cool. I like that one the best.
Have you not challenged your husband to something like get out there and do something as well?
You know, he'll join me for a swim every now and then. But, you know, we have our separate, like, interests, but they're all water-focused. So it's kind of nice. So when we go on vacation, we both can enjoy. He can surf, I can swim. It works well.
Have you been surprised by the limits, the physical and mental limits that you've got when you set out to do this?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty surprised by my mental aptitude for sure. I didn't underappreciate it before, but now seeing and helping crew on a lot of swims and seeing a lot of other swimmers and a lot of friends that I've met across the world, I think I definitely am in a different category than a lot of them, but I do surround myself by like minds. So our crazy is kind of equally appreciated and is supported. And we help one another kind of define that and kind of keep that edge, because I think it's a real attribute. Physically, yeah, I'm totally surprised because I'm 56 now. I am not necessarily what one would define as an elite appearing athlete. And I could blow your mind if I'm in the water. And I'm not fast either. I'm a solid swimmer. And that's also a mind blower because people will be like, wow, and you can keep going. And I'm like, yep. And I'm a strong swimmer, but I really think that I love surprising people. That's my favorite thing.
I interviewed an English woman who's an artist in New York called Chantel Martin. She does black and white line drawings, and she'd just done all of Times Square with her line drawings. And she based on this idea of you are you and asking the question, who are you? And Chantel's amazing sort of character. And she's done loads of collaborations with brands and this. But the one, when I interviewed her, she gave me this wonderful quote that I've published it a few times, where she talks about the way I think about life is I get into this rowing boat and I row out to the middle of a lake and I row and I row and I row. And around me, these ripples go out to the side of the lake. When I sit in the middle of the lake, they start to come back again. But the more of the ripples I not row, the more ripples come back to me. So that's the way I think about the impact in life. So you were talking there, I was thinking, you're having a ripple effect, not just on your children, your grandchildren, your near family. It's probably on the people around you. It's the other swimmers. It's your colleagues. It's your patients. Maybe people do start to reconsider what's possible and believe things that may have perceived to be beyond their capabilities to inspire people through the ripple effect that you're having, which I think is really interesting. So what would you say now at 56 years old and continuing with this, what other ambitions have you got for your swimming and the challenges that lie ahead?
Well, first and foremost, I get a lot of satisfaction of inspiring others. And that right there is so fulfilling. And I want that ripple effect to keep going. And that's where I get my most pleasure, is just seeing that come back and seeing how that does impact people. I love that. As far as my personal goals, I have a year and a half left to work. I'm going to finish out my profession. But as far as swimming goes, the next two swims that are on my radar and kind of in my wheelhouse and striking like distance is the Strait of Juan de Fuca, which is between the northern part of Washington, between Port Townsend and Victoria Island. And the reason I want to do that is I have a brother who lives in Vancouver, and he looks down the strait. But right now he's struggling with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And if I could do that to honor him, you know, he has to fight every day, but that might be a few hours worth of difficulty for me, but he could literally watch down the street, know I'm doing it. And that to me is a personal triumph that I'm aiming for. Probably next early summer. And then I'm celebrating my retirement by going back over to Scotland because I want to go look for the Loch Ness Monster. I want
to see. Oh, I'm going to have to come along and witness that.
Yes. Yes.
Can you let us? Yes. Can you let us know when that'll be?
Yeah, that's going to be probably August 2026. And so we're strategizing for that right now.
In Scotland in August.
Okay.
We'll have to make a time to go there for the weather.
That's great. Yeah, longer hours because that lake, they say, is a really hard one. It's cold. It's long distance. But they all, because of the peat, you know, bait lake bed, it's a black water. And so all the swimmers that swim it say they felt their soul being sucked out. And I think that just sounds so intriguing. And I just want to do it.
Wow. I think that's one to go and do a little documentary on.
Maybe.
We'll have to do that. Right. Sam, put that in the show notes. Log that one.
Yeah.
No, I'm not swimming. Are you kidding me?
I might get you in for a dip, though. I can be quite influential, you know?
Yeah, that's what worries me. I was telling Elaine, she said, don't you have any ideas about getting into that San Francisco Bay? I put my toes in there. I was like, are you kidding? I'm not a Wim Hof.
Well, it does help.
I did interview someone yesterday Noam Sagi, who's a Israeli psychotherapist turned functional health expert. And he's built this business in London called V2V. And what they look at is how to create personalized individual health based on biomarkers of 4D body scan. And the three treatments they give you is called breathe, freeze, and squeeze. So you go in this ionization chamber where they throw out all these negative ions to offset the positive ions we get bombarded with being in cities. You put in a cryotherapy chamber to minus 190 that shocks the system for 4 minutes, and then puts you into a squeeze thing, which is a NASA technology to get the blood flow to flush out all the toxins. And I've been in the cryotherapy chamber in Austin quite a few times, and I love it. But getting into cold water?
I think you would be surprised.
There's something different about it.
Mark, we got to try. I think I can get you. Honestly, and it's just, it takes your breath away. But, you know, like in that cryo chamber, you've already done even colder. You know, it just, it really afterwards, your body is just.
I've got a wee pair of boots on. A wee pair of gloves.
That's okay. You can wear the wee pair of gloves.
Wee pair of boots. That's fine.
Oh, my. Right. Can we change the subject, please? Let's talk about wine. Okay. Getting towards the end. What would your advice be to anyone? I'm not talking about myself. And I'm not a bad swimmer. I will say that. I was my school backstroke champion. What would you give your advice be to someone that's considering the first open water swim, apart from don't do it?
You know, honestly, the first thing that I would say to anybody that wants to embark out into open water, or as they call it over in Europe, wild swimming, it's you need to educate yourself kind of on what to expect as far as the water that you're going to enter. If you're going into a lake, you know, where are those hazards? Where are the drop-offs? Where are things you need to avoid? Safer entrance, safer exits. In the San Francisco Bay, learning a little bit about what constitutes a safer time to swim because of the currents, the tides, locations, where is safer to choose to swim? Because you might think that that cute little beach looks great right now, but then at a tide going out, you have to walk across a lot of rocks that might not be so pleasant on the way back. So you have to really take the time to kind of know what you're getting into physically first. And then try to meet somebody to be there with you, because, you know, misery always loves company. And the fact that the, you know, you're together is safer in general. Yeah. If you're swimming with friends, it just really is a safer option. And approach things slowly. Like, you do not have to go out and swim a marathon your first day. Like, limiting the time to just 10 minutes the first time you enter a water. And then building up from there is kind of how you got to do it. You got to do it gentle and slow. Build up your strength, your capability, and your comfort in that water. And you'd be surprised. But honestly, I've swam all over this world and have the most incredible engagement with people that have tried different things in different locations. And that's inspiring to me. But they took the time to really strategize and learn it first.
Apart from the physical benefits, what do you think the value is of pushing your body to that level for mental health?
Oh my gosh, it is so underappreciated, the mental health aspect of it. The cold water, first of all, is one of the best things for your mind. It literally chills you out. You go into the water and your brain can think of nothing. I think it's really freeing because we're always spinning in our heads.
So in a way, it's extreme meditation.
Yes. And that's exactly what you go to when you start getting in that rhythmic pattern of when you're swimming. So I think mentally, it's so good for that. And then it really calms down your emotions too, because if you can have a calm mind, your emotions will also mirror that. So the three benefits of the health and shocking your system with the colder water, they've proven that it has a huge impact. And the salt water in general, those ions really help preserve your ability to keep calm. And I think it's been on the increase of popularity. And I think the Gen Zers are really capturing cold plunging and the Wim Hof and all of these meditative and mental health as being a priority, I really appreciate that they're bringing it to the forefront.
On a personal level, what do you think has been the most rewarding aspect of your swimming?
The most rewarding aspect has been the connection with people worldwide. I literally met somebody at the airport yesterday that I've never physically met in person, but the connections that we have and the fact that he's an open water swimmer, he was joking with his colleagues. They're like, you don't know this person from a psycho killer. And he goes, oh, I know. When you meet another open water person, an open water swimmer who's in this community, you know what you're going to expect. Like, I picked him up at the airport. We did a double Alcatraz, which was on his bucket list of things to do.
Might not be psycho killer, but psycho definitely.
So Alcatraz, I mean, come on. But we both had the best time and it was fabulous. And just going anywhere in the world and meeting up with open water swimmers, we know what we're going to get. It's fabulous.
Wow. Amazing. You're almost persuading me. What misconceptions about marathon swimming or older athletes would you like to address?
You know, I think our society is just built around so many stereotypes that anytime somebody can challenge or question someone's mind about that stereotype, I think that's the best thing ever. I know that we've only thought our best athletes were in their younger 20s. And look in this past Olympics, there were several athletes in their 30s, 40s, had children. Like, we are blowing that stereotype out of the water as it is in our general athletic population. And I just think that the glass ceiling needs to be broken. And I'm so grateful that it's being challenged. And I am glad to be part of that as well.
What causes or issues would you like to bring to attention through your swimming?
You know, I have the usual ones of, you know, preserving and protecting clean water and, you know, any initiatives that support preservation there. I think just in, you know, the cancer research is really near and dear to my heart. I have now two brothers that have cancer that are now in their treatment phases. And, you know, that's terrifying for me. But, you know, they learned a lot through the genetic testing, and what we can accomplish with more research in that area is near and dear to my heart. But I just hope in general to support any cause that promotes kindness or interaction with compassion to one another. If we could be just good humans, I don't even care if it's just one individual just being kind to another one that they normally wouldn't have, that to me is a success. And that's the simplest gesture that hopefully can be, everybody can adapt. I would be more excited about that than anything else.
I wish our political leaders would sort of pay attention to that. Anyway, that's a different subject.
Yeah, exactly.
Who or what inspires you to keep getting up every day, getting in the water, and keep changing the world for the better?
God, I've got a lot of people that I use as my inspiration. I mentioned Sarah Thomas, who is a swimmer, who did 4 back-to-back English channels. You know, she's a cancer survivor, and she is also one of the most kind human beings I've ever met. There's another swimmer who was also from my childhood that was an idol, Lynn Cox. And not many people know about her, but she swam from the Aleutian Islands to Russia during the Cold War in the 80s. And she had to write letters to the government over on the coast where she was going to land, and she had no idea if she was going to be welcome on that shore. And sure enough, the day that she swam, they were there and they met her. And because of that swim, it was the beginning of the cooling of the Cold War. And I could tell you pivotally, if you do your research on that timeline, that was a pivotal point in breaking down the barricades and the barriers that dampened our Cold War. So she is so underappreciated, and that is one of those heroes that I have. And guess what? These are both women. Love it.
Yeah.
So those are my swimming inspirations.
We're all human. There are different ways we all have to deal with our own degree of uncertainty, self-doubt, fears, fear of heights. getting in cold water, sharks, jellyfish. How do you deal with it?
My mantra is I can do hard things. Very simple, but I usually just take a deep breath. I mutter that to myself under my breath and I just start, because no one's ever going to criticize you for just trying. And you might learn more out of a failure that could build you up for a better success later on. So you have nothing to lose by just trying. And I feel so lucky that I'm not the fastest and I'm not the best at anything, that I was able to kind of develop that if I just went out and tried it, that's pretty darn good. And if I can accomplish it and see what happens, that it's just opened up the world to me. And most of the population is in that category. So it's so important to remember that if you're not one of the top elite elites, you have so much more latitude to try and fail. And people might not even notice you even tried if you don't share that with them. But your own internal being will learn no matter what experience happened. So I don't set myself up for a disappointment, because everything that I accomplish, there's something to be gained by it.
That's good advice. Is there any book that you'd recommend that maybe helped you on your journey?
You know, I just recently read a book and I think it explained a lot for me. I take bits and pieces of a lot of books, but the latest book that I just read is called Tough Broads. It's by Caroline Paul. Just came out and was just published, and I just downloaded it, read it, and I actually met her last week and I took her for a swim. But
should be, I hope she's doing a season, doing a follow-up book and you're in it.
She reached out to me. She goes, I really wish I would have met you before we finished, but you know, who knows? There's another chapter always, ever, you know? But what I learned in that book was she backed a lot of the science behind as women aged and how in our middle age and later years, we're actually more adept and more set up to succeed with these incredible adventures that we try. And in her book, she does everything from bird watching to wing walking on an airplane and meeting up with the most incredible characters of, you know, aged in their middle 50s, 60s, up to like 90s. And these women are so powerful. And I just loved it. It resonated with my soul and kind of just, you know, put a blanket over, that's exactly how to tuck in this package right here of what this accomplishment means.
How'd you meet her?
She reached out to me. She lives here in San Francisco. She's an author. And she reached out to me because, of course, when she said, I just wrote this book, Tough Broads, and you know, you define this role, I had to reach back out. And I really enjoy her as an individual as well. I think we're soul sisters in a lot of senses, but it's just, I love meeting powerful women. I think it's time that we get a little bit more respect society-wise. And I just love this attention and this kind of enlightenment. It's nice.
That's wonderful. I interviewed another person early on in the podcast, Dr. Merit Moore, who's young, probably in her mid-30s now. She is a quantum physicist ballerina and trained as an astronaut.
Oh, she is amazing.
I mean, and her sister was like head of strategy for the Department of Defense, age 32. Are you going, what? I mean, yeah. What about a power family? And Merit is incredible. And she was featured in a book, a cartoon book for young girls all about, and I can't remember what it's called, but I think you'd like it. I'll send it. I'll put it in the show notes and send it to you.
Oh, please.
But
please
Merit,
do.
Merit ticks that box as far as you're concerned.
Oh, yeah. I mean, anytime you can give somebody an example of what to aspire to, I think it just really does kind of challenge and break those glass ceilings, which I just push those horizons. Love it. Just love it.
Cool. Is there any simple life hack or behavior that you've discovered that would you think people should be aware of?
I think that the...
Apart from getting in cold water every day.
Apart from getting cold water every day. I think the biggest thing is if you can take a minute to not look at the whole thing and break down whatever it is, whether it be even just a problem in your life. If you look at the entirety, it's overwhelming and kind of exhausting to imagine, how am I going to get through this? But if you break it down in manageable pieces, you can accomplish anything. And also, as you're doing that, to take a moment to look back to see how far you've gone and to celebrate those accomplishments, because that will encourage you to keep going, even when that road is steep, even when it's straight up. But you could find that switchback. You could figure it out. But if you could just break it down, I think that's the most important advice.
That's great advice. Any documentary, show, movie that's inspired you that you think people should watch?
Oh, goodness. There's a lot of them. I really loved Young Woman in the Sea, about Trudy Ederle, the first woman who swam the English Channel. I thought that was brilliantly done. It was underappreciated. There's also a movie that was made about Mercedes Glintz, over a European swimmer. She was from Britain, and she swam the North Channel and did a lot of things that were kind of under the radar. That movie just came out, and I can't think of the name of that one off the top of my head. I just like anything that has just a good storyline. But those are the two that are swimming related that just came out literally this year. This was the year of the women. The Diana Nyad movie also came out. So all three of those came out around the same time frame. And of course, the one from Britain got a lot more attention overseas. Wasn't as popular here in the States, but it's still a brilliant show. So to put that out there.
We're all about reciprocity, connecting others who are like-minded. So if you're open to it, what we call random collisions, really engineer collisions between different guests, if you're open to it, we'll do it. I definitely think you'd probably need to be connected with someone like Chantel.
Love
and
it.
Also with Merritt. I think you two would hit it off. So yeah, so we'd like to see if there's serendipity results through some sort of connection. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, that was, because there was no end in sight. Like, they had no idea. Yeah, that's...
Well, on that, Amy, thank you very much for making the time. And the final question for you is, who do I interview next?
Goodness, I have my list. So the first person, who's one of my dear friends, is Cameron Bellamy. He has rowed from Australia to Africa with a team of rowers. He also was featured because he rowed Antarctica to the South Pole. And there's a documentary about him on National Geographic. He has done the Ocean 7 swims. I met him in Gibraltar. And we swam Gibraltar together. And he's one of the dearest people that I know. He's just finished his master's in quantum physics.
Oh, well, okay.
And his brother is one of the top models for Ralph Lauren. And so but he's the most humble man. His father was an incredible sailor, and his mother was an equestrian and top of her, like,
talk about in the genes, huh?
Oh, yeah, completely. And he was a Rhodes Scholar, went to Rhodes, rowed there, and was a rower. So he's an amazing individual. But he also was working in the stock market because he did internet security, was his profession, and actually still is. He quit his job from Beijing, and he got a bicycle and literally cycled from Beijing to the tip of India. Yeah, but he's only like in his like 30s. Maybe in his 40s now.
So yeah. Making someone feel their wasted life.
Oh my gosh. But he's an incredible person, and I have his contact information.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's start with him and see where we get to. It makes me think, as you're talking, I don't know if you've read the book Endurance.
Yes.
About obviously the Antarctic and the ship. I mean, that's one of the most inspiring books about the potential, the power of human endurance to have rowed to South Georgia in a rowing boat, not knowing you're going to survive, and leaving guys in the ice to survive for 2 years on seal blubber.
Okay.
It's
mind blowing. Yeah.
I think if there's any book I've read, I think that proves the physical endurance of human beings as well as the mental fortitude, is that sharing your story. It is truly extraordinary, awfully inspiring. And yeah, we'll have to, maybe I'll go and run away and try and get away from the cold water before you drag me in there.
You could come up with every excuse in the book.
Okay.
It's good.
But thank you very much. And I look forward to continue to follow your story as you take it to Loch Ness. And I'm aim to be there to witness that.
I think that would be awesome.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's all for now, folks. Now, here's my ask of you. Please follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever player you use. Also, please subscribe to our new Random Collisions newsletter. We really are working to build a global community of action takers, action engines of people that really care about the problems that need solving. Thank you very much, and see you next time.